This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the 18th century, explorers set out to catalog the varieties of life on Earth. Until then, even educated people believed that monsters and creatures from mythology lurked outside the relative safety of their known environments. Today, there are 2 million documented species on Earth, a far cry from the 4,400 listed by Swedish botanist Carolus Linnaeus back in 1758. Even that number is astonishing, considering that the bold and great lengths a few ambitious men had to go to discover and catalog the mysteries of the natural world. The exploits of these colorful explorers play like adventure stories in a new book, The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth by Richard Conniff. Richard, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, nice to be here, Virginia.
The first species seekers set out to explore the world in the Great Age of Discovery. So describe that time, that backdrop for us.
For these people, going out to distant corners of the Earth was more dangerous than going to the moon is for us. I mean, first of all, it would take 6 months or a year to get to some of these places. They stood a high likelihood of dying. So Linnaeus sent out 19 of his students. Half of them did not come back.
Well, there are 6 main seekers in your book. Some of the side characters are also very fantastic. So let's start with where you start in the book. This is at the height of battle with a certain Colonel de Jean. Tell us a little bit about him.
So he was in the French army, and it was during the Peninsular Wars in Spain. And he was also a coleopterist. That is, he collected beetles. So he was going into battle one day, and he had a challenge of charging uphill into the Spanish cannons. The air was full of gunpowder and blood and gore, and he looks down from his horse and he sees this beetle by a stream that he had never seen before. So he gets off his horse, collects it, pins it inside his helmet, and then gets back on the horse and says, "Charge!" And in the ensuing battle, 600 of his soldiers died. His helmet was blasted to pieces, but he survived, and so did that specimen.
You write, in the 18th century, London, this fervor that we just heard a little bit about manifested in some very strange journeys of exotic animals. Tell us, for example, why an eel was brought to London in a cask of rum.
So they actually shipped 5 of them from South America, and one of them survived to make it to London. And they were interested in it because it was electrical, and everything electrical was fascinating at that time, Ben Franklin and all that sort of thing. And then they had a kind of party, a scientific party, where everybody gathered in this one house in London, and they had an electric eel, and one person grabbed it on one end and then held hands with 27 other people in a ring and grabbed it on the other end, and the electric shock ran through them all. And that was kind of a kick, kind of a thrill, and also told them something about the natural world that they hadn't known before, that there was this electrical basis for these biological actions.
Well, one of my most favorite chapters in the book talks about the conundrum of what to do with the species once they have been collected. So enter Charles Waterton. How did he come to change this game?
So Charles Waterton was, like a lot of these characters, eccentric. And he was interested in species not so much to name them, but to bring them back to life, that is, to stuff them and arrange them in a way that actually reflected how they lived in the wild. So he spent enormous amounts of time looking at how a bird sat on a branch, for instance, and then trying to recapture that. And it was kind of like he was interested in reincarnation. Up until about the 1820s or 1830s, everything that you collected pretty much rotted away before too long. But about that time, arsenic came in and various other preservatives, and that made it possible to keep these things and build up large collections and make comparisons of one to another, and that really helped people understand a lot more about the natural world.
How did this sudden discovery of so many species affect the predominantly Christian, European, and American vision of God's individual divine creations?
We tend to think of this as a story just about the discovery of evolution by natural selection. And really, it was a lot more profound than that. And one of the big changes happened in the end of the 18th century because of a species that had been discovered in the United States. It was they called it the incognitum, but it was a mastodon. And a French anatomist named Georges Cuvier used the mastodon and other specimens that he had of African elephants and Indian elephants and Siberian mammoths to demonstrate that the mastodon was in fact extinct. And that was a pretty profound shock because it meant that a part of God's creation had actually disappeared from the face of the earth. And up until then, everybody believed in this perfect chain of being where from the lowest creature to the highest, everything, every place, every possible place was filled and everything was sort of designed to stay that way forever.
How many species are left yet to discover?
Well, that's a big subject of debate. So a recent study came out and said that probably we have 10 million species on Earth, so we have another 8 million to go. But others have said 50 million to 100 million. I think the point is that really, even after 150 years of discovery, 200 years, we know very little of the natural world. And what we don't know about what's disappearing all around us right now could actually be pretty critical information.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and I really want to thank you. Great to speak with you.
Thank you, Virginia.
Richard Conniff, a Guggenheim Fellow, winner of the National Magazine Award and guest columnist for the New York Times. His new book is The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth. You can find more on the book, including some terrific reviews, at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget that you can seek us on Facebook and on Twitter. No life or limb required. If agriculture is cultivating food, apiculture raising bees, and arboriculture growing trees, then what the heck is permaculture? NHPR's Sam Evans Brown schlepped up to New Hampshire's frozen north to talk to people who practice permaculture and found that the term contains multitudes.
This is Dee Acres, a teaching farm in Dorchester, New Hampshire, spitting distance from the White Mountains.
So my name's Keith Morris.
My name is Steve Whitman.
And I'm here teaching the Permaculture Through the Seasons Permaculture Design Certification course.
Coming towards the end of the second permaculture design course to be run here.
I came to get an answer to a straightforward question. What is permaculture? But the soundbite wasn't forthcoming. Ask six people and you'll get six responses.
My name is Teresa. Permaculture, to me, is living in communion with your environment.
Obviously, there's many definitions of permaculture.
So permaculture, to me, is sustainable ecological design.
But in a nutshell, I would say it is integrating your life to become part of the natural
system. Permaculture is just that. It's simple.
At this class, the students, the teachers, everyone answers with dense, jargony boilerplate. But to break it down, it's about efficient buildings, waste management, saving and generating electricity, catching and using rainwater, and a whole hodgepodge of other topics. It's about smart, green systems that reduce the energy and resources that our lives require. But the best way to understand permaculture is to see it on the ground. Students at this weekend's class give us their favorite examples. First, here's Sarah Dunham.
Consciously thinking about my waste work, so I have worms, composting worms in my apartment. I try to make a lot of things by hand rather than buying them from somewhere. You know, if I can make it, I do.
And this is Jill Winton.
I would have to say the herb spiral is pretty cool. Basically, it's a mound of dirt to make a three-dimensional planting bed, and you can plant herbs that were, like, dry and hot near the top on the sunny side and plants that, like, cool and moist towards the back.
Permaculture is not just about agriculture. It's a school of design. And it's not just embracing trees and doing yoga in parks, though all that isn't incompatible with permaculture. Sometimes it can be about making money. Keith Morris talks about a test piece in class. It's a project in Milwaukee called Growing Power, which was started by former NBA player Will Allen. On a tiny 2-acre city plot, Growing Power is raising fish, bees, chickens, ducks, and goats, as well as growing sprouts, fresh greens, and herbs. There's a quarter million worth of food in 2 acres of parking lot. And Morris says that when Allen got there, there was zero soil.
And they have a large and well-established composting operation where they're getting food residuals from all the restaurants and cafeterias and schools and supermarkets in the region, composting that.
In that urban waste dirt, the crew plants sprouts and greens that are grown dense, harvested fast, and sold for a pretty penny. The centerpiece of the operation are tanks of tilapia, flanking greenhouses. They sell them for $6 a fish, but also...
What happens when you keep a ton of fish in a tank, like wall-to-wall, gill-to-gill? Well, they foul the water, like, almost immediately.
The fish manure water is pumped out of the fish tanks into vegetable beds. The veggies, incidentally,
by the end of the troughs, have it filtered and it goes back to the fish in a constant recirculation.
It's permaculture. I asked Steve Whitman if permaculture is just common sense.
I think common sense is a huge aspect of this. Often we'll say at the beginning of a course that if some of this seems intuitive or like common sense, that's a good thing because you can't teach common sense, but there's a lack of common sense in a lot of decisions we make today.
Permaculture has been around for a while, but recently has started to wriggle into the mainstream. Gardens on roofs, food instead of lawns, green building and houses that gather and store heat from the sun without any PV panels or hot water tubes. That's all part of it, too. But really, permaculture is putting all of this together, and Whitman thinks that that's what's so hard to grasp.
I think people can wrap their heads around aspects of it. People can understand the value of organic agriculture, or they can understand the value of the local food movement, the local products, or things that seem tangible. To look at the big picture and see how all these pieces may or may not fit together is probably more than the average person is willing to dig into initially.
But you still can't find many people who know the word. The people who drove all the way up here this weekend, they don't much care. They, like permaculture, are solution-oriented, and so haven't stopped to consider how long it will take for the rest of us to catch on. But if someone seeing what they're up to says, hey, that makes sense, it'll be fine by them. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
Yeah, it doesn't even give off any heat.
I know, because it's so efficient.
And for more about permaculture, dig into wordofmouthradio.org or check out the conversation sprouting on our Facebook page. Coming up, a pioneering neuroscientist takes aim at what he calls neurotrash, the proliferation of brain science hype, which he finds ultimately pessimistic. You're listening to Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.